ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Artemis 2 is go, the first human mission to the moon in more than 50 years. And we are following every step of the journey, from lunar flyby to splashdown, in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Join me, Belinda Smith, for mission updates so you know what's happening and why it matters. It's Artemis Explained. Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
I've had my flu vaccine, Norman, have you?
I wanted to have it, silly me being goody two shoes. So I go into my local pharmacy and I was baring my arm as I walked in, and the pharmacist said, don't go any further. We don't have it. Come back next week.
We just got them in the clinic. I got one in my arm with the nurse because I'd seen the numbers of the amount of flu circulating. My children have asked me for the intranasal vaccine this year. There are some changes in 2026, and this is everything we're covering on the Health Report today. I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal land.
Also coming up on the show, obstructive sleep apnea in children can be tricky. Kids can have daytime sleepiness, concentration issues. And it used to be that surgery, removal of the tonsils and the adenoids was the solution. But things are changing and nasal sprays are potentially the future.
Interesting. And also on the show, we are going to talk about enlarged prostates. Enlarged prostates are an issue. Surgery's been the answer. Turns out there's a relatively new technique which actually can sort out your prostate without surgery.
So it's a non-surgical health report this week.
Perhaps.
In the news, vaping. And I didn't think this was news, Norman, but I guess it's confirmation of something that we all suspected, that vaping is very likely to cause cancer.
Yeah, this is a study which is actually an Australian study, people at the University of New South Wales and elsewhere. And what they were looking at was, you know, it's too early in terms of the reduction of vaping to see people coming down with cancer. But are you going to wait until you've got an epidemic of lung cancer or cancer of the mouth before?
Because it can take years to collect that data.
20, 30 years.
Yes, decades.
It's a long process before you develop cancer. Some will develop it earlier, but not many. So this is looking at the journey to cancer, if you like, in your body. You know, and the potential here is that the flavourings that get heated up are carcinogenic. Nicotine itself can actually spin off some carcinogens and other stuff in vapes, which can increase oxidative stress and do all sorts of things to your body. So they wanted to see if you actually, what was the sum total of research in terms of vaping, nicotine vaping, and its effects on your body, on your immune system, and on the absorption of substances which might be carcinogenic.
It's quite interesting the way they've done this because they've looked at a huge pool of data and they've looked at human studies, animal studies, and then the kind of mechanistic evidence on what these volatile organic compounds do on lung tissue. They've really looked at everything, haven't they, from mid-2017 to 2025.
And it's not just in the test tube, it's in animals, and it's in humans themselves.
It's looked at everything, and I know that you're a reader. The graphical abstract on this article, and we always put the articles in the show notes, shows you the kind of snapshot that they've tried to attain to see whether or not these devices increase the risk, whether they're a carcinogen, essentially. Do they cause cancer?
And so their prediction is that you will see oral and lung cancer evolving as a result of vapes. And the important public health question is here that people are saying, well, nicotine vapes are safe and a much safer alternative to smoking. Well, we don't know that. And the indication here is that they might not be.
In the news, peanut allergy. We talked a lot about food allergies recently, but yeah. This is about oral immunotherapy for peanut allergy, and is it a cost-effective intervention? So if I diagnose you, Norman, with peanut allergy, we normally say the standard of care, and that's as per the guidelines from ASCIA, that Australasian Society of Clinical Immunology and Allergy, avoid the peanut, Norman. That's the standard of care.
Total avoidance.
But for some people, immunotherapy, slowly and very carefully in a supervised medical setting, introducing the peanut protein, gradually escalating over time can actually be a beneficial treatment. It's previously been shown to be quite effective.
And it can get some people into remission, and certainly it can increase your tolerability to peanut. And there's two ways of doing it. One is peanut, and the other is peanut associated with a probiotic. And this probiotic is a lactobacillus. So this is Australian research done at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. And they chose this particular probiotic because it does affect the immune system, the T cells that are involved in allergy. And they thought that it could actually enhance the effectiveness of that. And in fact, they've shown this to be the case, reduce the gastrointestinal, the tummy upset side effects that you can get with this.
So they've had 201 children. This was a multi-centre randomised placebo-controlled trial. So it involved three different Australian hospitals. They randomised the group into either receiving some form of that oral immunotherapy, that gradually increasing dose of peanut protein. Some of them had the probiotic you're speaking of. Some of them didn't. The rest of them just had avoidance and no immunotherapy. And what they found is essentially that, you know, the kids who underwent oral immunotherapy, it was effective, but they were really looking at, was it cost effective? And the answer is yes, it is. It is cost effective. And they looked at how many doctors, nurses, the cost of the medication, the cost of adverse events. They looked at everything, and it is a cost effective intervention.
And the probiotic had the edge on quality in terms of quality of life. But there wasn't really that much difference between the two interventions.
But it cost more, the probiotic one, just a tiny bit. Vaccination is a big part of the health report this week. And in the news, the National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance in Australia has released their coverage report for 2025. And it's not really good news.
No, big decline in the number of children vaccinated at 12 months. So we're not talking about influenza here. We're talking about the standard schedule in the first 12 months of life, down to 90%. And that's getting down to the level where if we had an introduction of measles, it would spread in the country and we'd lose our measles elimination status.
And I think the other really sad news is the decline in coverage rates of human papillomavirus or HPV in adolescents. So 2 out of 10 adolescents had not received an HPV dose by the age of 15. And that vaccine is, of course, preventing cervical cancer. It protects against anal cancer.
Pharyngeal cancer and possibly even esophageal cancer.
And so when we talk about potentially completely eliminating cervical cancer by 2035, it really does rely on a vaccination coverage rate of 90% for HPV. And we are now fallen below that. So that's devastating news.
It is.
I guess the big question is, Norman, why? Why are we seeing the decline? Because this report gives you the numbers. And I think as a clinician, what should I be doing to increase vaccination rates in adolescents and in children, timely vaccination? I think people are really confused with the amount of misinformation and stuff coming out of the US.
So the answer is, you're just putting a public health hat on here. There's probably not much you can do as a general practitioner, although there's lots of evidence that short conversations by general practitioners can actually change people's behaviour and make a big difference. So it's not nothing, but you've got to have lower friction so that parents remember to get their vaccine done. Most of this is not vaccine hesitancy. It's just people being busy, forgetting to do it, you know, having reminders, which we've spoken about before in the health report, and just tackling every little aspect of the problem so that you're not putting all your money on one thing and just say people are anti-vaccine, which is not true.
Well, I don't think that necessarily people are anti-vaccine, but I do disagree that I think it is just people are busy, because remembering that last year we covered that declining vaccine confidence amongst Australian parents report that came out that said that parents actually were feeling more confused with a lot of the misinformation and stuff coming out of the US. I think that people are perhaps more uncertain and anxious, and I think there is a big role for speaking to someone that you trust who is qualified. But I think that there is other stuff grumbling, not just people are busy.
Lots happening in the Australian community, which may have nothing to do with medicine. You're listening to The Health Report here on Radio National. So Priya, we talked about at the beginning that, you know, this is the flu season coming up. We've got to be vaccinated. We're going to get an update in a minute. Have you got people flocking in the door?
We do. I actually had mine.
Did you?
I had it. I'm nervous about needles, but I've gone and gotten it done because of the numbers.
Well done, you.
And that person that you're hearing there is Professor Patrick Redding, who's director of the WHO Collaborating Centre for Reference and Research on Influenza at the Doherty Institute. We'll come back to you in a second, Patrick, because I'm really keen to hear what... So you've had yours. I went in to have mine, and they didn't have any for me, so...
We just got them. We just got them, Norman.
Right.
So go back, because they're in fridges now.
I will go back. Now, one of the reasons I'll go back, Patrick, is this fascinating study that the Doherty just published. You weren't on the paper. And it's kind of looking at something that I find really interesting. We talked about a lot during COVID, and it's called original antigenic sin. So do you want to just tell us, here's your starter for 10, you know, what original antigenic sin is, Patrick?
Yeah, original antigenic sin means, I guess, that some of the immune memory responses that we recall, for example, with vaccination, can actually be take over a little bit from the new vaccine responses that we're trying to elicit to the latest virus, for example. So this is really the term, I guess, original antigenic sin. It's kind of, yeah, a bit of an override of the type of immune response that you want to induce to the latest strains by previously primed cells in your immune system.
So it's the idea that your early exposure, particularly if you're around about the age of five, might define how you respond later on. But in a sense, this paper contradicts that a little bit because they looked at people who might have been exposed to the 1918 flu virus and then who'd been immunized in the 90s and how that influenced their immune responses to influenza later on in life.
Yeah, I think they were comparing young and older adults that had received vaccines in 1994. And then, yeah, the question, I guess, was what was the quality of those immune response induced to the vaccine? But yeah, they're having such a historic cohort, they could ask the interesting question, can the antibodies induced, you know, to a 1994 vaccine strain actually recognize some of the future strains in the three sort of seasonal influenza vaccines that we have that continue to circulate in our community?
So what I've found, which, and you'll correct me, no doubt, Patrick, if I get it wrong, is that there was a benefit in terms of adaptability of your immune system to new influenza viruses later on in your life. But it was only for H1N1. We'll come back to these codes for strains in a minute. Not the H3 version. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. I think we'll talk more about the different seasonal viruses that we have today, but essentially there's two influenza A viruses, the H1N1 and the H3N2. And then there's now one influenza B virus. We call it a B Victoria lineage virus. And they found that they saw these sort of reactive antibodies that elicited to the H1N1 and the B components of the vaccine that were able to see future strains. So up to 30 years ahead, they could find some cross-reactivity, I guess, with different parts of the hemagglutinin spike. And that's the main spike that we make antibodies to when we get flu vaccines.
So that's pretty incredible. But is there something wrong with the way we're making H3 vaccines, that we're not getting the effect with those?
We're going to talk a bit more about H3s when we talk to our recent and upcoming flu seasons, because I think we've always regarded probably H3s as the problem child of the seasonal influenza viruses. And by the problem child, I guess I mean it tends to have a higher, the way it looks to the immune system, its antigenic characteristics and its genetic characteristics tend to evolve and change faster than the H1N1 component and the B virus as well. So we find that we need to make updates to the H3N2 component of our seasonal influenza vaccines more often than we do to the H1N1 and the B components. So we're always sort of chasing it, and probably more so than the other two components.
So what does this year's vaccine actually cover then, Patrick? Because it changes every year, it evolves. What are people expecting this year to be covered?
This year we've got three components to the flu vaccine, the H1N1, the H3N2, and the B component. And in the WHO sort of vaccine consultation meetings, where we get data from all around the world and we look at the latest viruses that are emerging, we updated two components of that vaccine for the Southern Hemisphere, so including Australia. And that's the H1N1 component and the H3N2 component. The B component did not change for the Southern Hemisphere vaccine.
Well, in terms of the early flu cases that are emerging now in Australia. What's your guess as to the proportion of people who contract influenza are going to be covered by this vaccine?
I'll just take one little step back to say that 2025 was kind of a crazy year. We normally see a nice peak of influenza activity in the winter months. So increasing in June, July, August, you know, and then coming down September onwards. And last year's season was really strange. We had that early season where we had a nice big peak in winter, and that was a H1N1 virus. But what we saw emerging from September onwards was a H3N2 virus. And that basically stayed elevated right through till Christmas. And that was what we now know as this K variant virus. So that virus caused a really late and extended season in 2025 in Australia. And then it moved up to the Northern Hemisphere and it dominated their winter, which runs through December, January, February. So across Europe, across the US, across China.
So we gave them a wee present, did we?
Yeah. I think between Australia and New Zealand, we kind of cooked that one up and sent it up north. So
what about earlier this year, Patrick? Because this year there's already been over 20,000 lab-confirmed cases of influenza, so there's likely more than that that people aren't testing for or they're testing at home.
Yeah.
What variant is that that we think is causing the issue?
So what we're generally seeing is a continuation of the K variant of H3N2 that's circulating at low, relatively low levels compared to what we see in winter. But certainly we came through to the end of last year with elevated H3N2, and we're seeing that tick down slowly, but it's still circulating even though we've moved through summer, and we're now looking to sort of accelerate into winter and probably see a new peak arising very soon. So what I would say is that the H3N2 component of the vaccine that's updated for the season in 2026 provides a better match against this K variant than the vaccine that we had last year. So that's a good thing, I think. When we try and predict what's going to happen looking forward as the winter comes in Australia, at the moment we're seeing the H3N2 circulating, but we're also seeing a little bit of influenza B activity. And it can vary a little bit state to state. And what's been happening in the Northern Hemisphere in countries like the US is they had a big peak of that K variant of H3N2. But as they moved into January and February, they started seeing more and more of the influenza B viruses. So that was also seen in Japan. So it's a little bit unpredictable to tell what's going to be seeded into our community and take off as we move into the 2026 winter in Australia. But what I would say is we've done our best to update two out of the three components of the vaccine to give us a better match against the emerging viruses going into 2026.
So briefly and finally, Patrick, just give us a sense of what vaccines are available to people, because there have been changes in the kinds of vaccines too.
Classically in Australia, we have these inactivated vaccines. And that means basically the virus has been killed and it's injected into your arms. And that forms part of the National Immunisation Program. That is free to kids under 6 months and less than 5 years, all adults over 65, pregnant women, people with specified medical conditions, and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people 6 months and over. So that's the classic vaccine. And we have some enhanced vaccines available for the elderly. What that means is they might have a little stimulant to help elderly people who don't have such good immune responses to get a better immune response. Or they might have just a little bit more of the viral components in it to help them make a better immune response.
So just to define elderly there for a moment, because I thought this was now available to people aged over 50 rather than 65.
Well, it's not funded though, but it's a possibility, yes.
It's definitely, so we're talking about what's free on the National Immunisation Program, but I would highlight that from your pharmacy or your GP, you can obtain influenza vaccines. They're probably about a bit over $20 a shot for the intramuscular or the injection that we're used to. So states and territories can have slightly different immunisation programs that they fund internally as well. But what I wanted to highlight, I guess, in as an alternative, particularly for children to what we're used to with these injectable flu vaccines, is that there's now these live attenuated vaccines. And what that basically means is there's a vaccine called FluMist that's available, and it represents a little spray that goes up the nose. And in Australia, children aged 2 to under 18 years are eligible to receive this, although it's not part of the national immunisation program. But there are state-based funding available to support it in New South Wales, South Australia, Queensland and Western Australia.
I said it was going to be the final point, but the final point is, if this is a live vaccine, does it solve some of the problems of influenza vaccines, which they don't necessarily last that long? And because they're killed vaccines, they might not get a very high antibody level?
The overall effectiveness of this vaccine, the live attenuated vaccine, it's been used for many years in the Northern Hemisphere, places like the UK, in children. Overall, the efficacy of this vaccine is pretty similar to the intramuscular injection. But what I would say is, for particularly children, the idea of a spray up your nose and a local infection in your upper respiratory tract is often preferable to a needle injection.
Yes. My kids have already put their order in, Patrick, so both my children have committed me to that. But I think also with the recent data coming out about immunisation and flu vaccines, the uptake in children tends to be suboptimal. So hopefully this might be more acceptable to parents and children, and we might see an increase in the rates of vaccination against the flu.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting opportunity for us to see if we can enhance the immunisation rates in kids, which have really dropped away, particularly post-COVID. That's the younger kids are a group where we've really seen reductions in, you know, the proportion of people vaccinated. So hopefully moving away from a needle towards sort of a spray up the nose will encourage parents to sort of vaccinate their kids. So that's kind of the hope this year. So it'll be really interesting to generate the data and see how that goes this year.
Patrick, thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Professor Patrick Redding from the Doherty Institute in Melbourne.
You're with the Health Report on ABC Radio National. Kids and sleep-disordered breathing or snoring can have a really big impact on parents and caregivers and children. They can be sleepy in the day, have concentration issues, and often people expect to be referred for surgery, for removal of the adenoids and the tonsils. There are long wait lists, particularly in the public system, and surgery is not risk-free. There's new research suggesting that nasal sprays might be an easy, cost-effective solution.
And talking about solutions, what's in the solution?
Well, you have to listen.
Okay.
And the person I spoke to...
I'm jumping ahead here. Okay.
Tune in, turn the volume up. The person I spoke to is Adjunct Clinical Professor Gillian Nixon, who's a paediatric sleep and respiratory specialist at Monash Children's Hospital.
Snoring and difficulty breathing during sleep, which is what we call obstructive sleep disorder breathing, is really common in children. Parents will often notice noisy breathing, sometimes not frank snoring like adults would do, but noisy or constricted breathing. And often they have difficulty breathing as well, so they don't look comfortable with their breathing. They're putting increased effort into their breathing. Sometimes they have pauses, so the airway becomes intermittently completely blocked, and then they will snort or gasp. And that disturbs sleep if it's happening multiple times a night.
And so that can then have implications for the daytime. I guess the child is tired and potentially not focusing as well at school.
That's right. And those are the main implications for children. We know that children who don't sleep well can have difficulties with behaviour, just having less tolerance for things, being more emotional. And also, as you say, in school-aged children and in preschool children, having difficulty concentrating, focusing, getting on with their peers, etc. So it certainly can have really significant impacts on their quality of life and their daytime as well as their sleep.
So I think a lot of people will be aware that for these children with this obstructive sleep apnea, often it might be surgical management, so removing those big tonsils and adenoids to try and open up the airways. What does your study look at? Because it's looking at the medical management of this and potentially trying to avoid surgery if possible. Can you just explain what you did in the study?
Yeah, so that was the premise of the study, is that we know that taking out tonsils and adenoids can be very effective for this problem. But because it affects so many children, we wanted to investigate alternative treatments, so things that we could do before we thought about a surgical approach. And ideally, we wanted to study things that could be done in conjunction with a general practitioner so that people could avoid the need to wait for long periods to see a specialist to discuss treatment. So the treatment that we've been interested in, the treatments really that we've been interested in over the last few years, and this is the second trial we've done in this area, are nasal sprays. But there have been some previous studies suggesting that steroid-based nasal sprays, such as you might use for hay fever, can be really helpful in managing snoring and sleep apnea in children. And so we set out to, in our previous study, to compare normal saline, which is just salt water, to steroids for children with snoring and obstructive sleep disorder breathing. And we actually found that they were equally effective at resolving the symptoms. We designed the trial so that all the children who were enrolled in the study had the saline first, because that's cheaper, it's easily available, and potentially with less side effects. So we gave everyone that. And again, we saw about 1 in 3 had complete resolution of their symptoms just with the saline salt water spray.
And how long for, Gillian?
6 weeks. And then what we did was we randomised then the people who didn't respond in those 6 weeks to have either the steroid-based spray or 6 more weeks of saline. And again, we showed that there was equivalent. So another group of children, if they went for 12 weeks altogether, regardless of what the type of spray that they had, had resolution of their symptoms by the end of 12 weeks.
The potential implication is that more children will respond to this therapy and potentially avoid surgery altogether.
Correct. That's our goal, is to find treatments, is to promote treatments that are alternatives or first steps, I guess, before people consider a surgical option.
What are the potential side effects if people are considering this? Because it's quite, you know, it sounds effective, it's quite available, it's cheap. As you said, it's available without a prescription. What are the potential side effects people can expect for their child?
The main side effects we were interested in were nosebleeds. So spraying anything up the nose can contribute to more prevalent nosebleeds. And we certainly saw a small number of children having that. There was no difference between the saline or the steroid in terms of side effects. You can get itchiness or irritation of the nose as well, but nothing more serious than that.
I think a lot of people will be aware, if you get referred to a public department for this kind of issue, the wait list can be quite significant to see an ear, nose and throat surgeon. So people can wait months, if not years, for even the appointment, let alone the surgery. Mm-hmm. Is the hope, Gillian, that this might actually take some of the burden off the public system and actually achieve symptom control and improvement in quality of life for the kids?
Yes, absolutely. That's really what we're looking for. We know that some children will need the surgery and that it's very effective for those children. But at the moment, as you say, it's the wait for to see a specialist and to get the surgery is very long. And so some children who have very severe symptoms and clearly would benefit most from the surgery have a lot of difficulty getting in. So both there's benefits potentially in children avoiding the surgery, but also children who truly need it having more access to that specialist care.
At the moment, Gillian, do we have a sense of how many kids are actually receiving a saline spray for a prolonged period of time before they're referred on? Do we know how much this is happening at the minute?
No, we don't know that at the moment. I'm certainly seeing in my clinical practice that that's starting to come through, that people are trying nasal sprays before they're referred, but I couldn't quantify that for you.
And I guess the takeaway from this study is that if you're going to try a nasal spray, go with the kind of cheapest, most available, try the saline, and you can potentially put someone on that and then also refer them. So whilst they're waiting, they could try this therapy and maybe they don't need to see the non-GP specialist ENT surgeon.
Yes, I think that's what we'd hope. We'd certainly encourage people to talk about the problems that they're observing in their child with their GP, because their GP can then help them plan a management kind of pathway. But we'd be really encouraging them to try the saline spray as a first step.
Professor Gillian Nixon from Monash Children's Hospital.
Good news.
It is good news. Nasal sprays, that's an easy solution and much easier than surgery if you can get away with it, if it works.
Yeah. Or do you have to pin the child down to the bed to get it up their schnoz? But that's
that's parents, a new challenge.
That's for parents to deal with.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. So, Norman, how's your prostate? Because I know your next story revolves around that.
my prostate's in great shape, thank you very much. I haven't asked it recently, but, you know, the last time I spoke to it, it said, fine, thank you very much. And, you know, I'm not getting up 16 times a night, you know, and all the other little symptoms that people complain about. But, you know, this is not about my prostate. It's about everybody else's prostate.
Thank goodness.
So we do talk a lot about prostate cancer. This is not a story about prostate cancer. This is a story about benignly enlarged prostates. And it can disrupt people's quality of life. You know, they are getting up a lot. They're not sleeping well. They're going to the bathroom a lot. They get left with urine in their bladders, which means that, you know, they've just finished passing water, then they've got to go again. You know, it really can disrupt men's lives significantly. So most of the treatment has been surgical for this. Well, there's medical treatment, drugs, probably not that great in terms of effectiveness. There's traditional surgery where they core it out using a knife. There's lasers, there's steam, there's all sorts of technologies now which are effectively surgical to core out the prostate. But there's this relatively new technique, which is called prostate artery embolization. And this is where a non-surgeon actually does the procedure, an interventional radiologist who's going to explain how it's done. But it's a day procedure and you can have it done when you're awake and is quite effective. And they've just published a trial looking at prostate artery embolization versus medication. And the person I spoke to is Associate Professor Nick Brown, who's an interventional radiologist and clinical director of radiology at the Wesley Hospital in Brisbane.
Prostate artery embolization is a non-surgical, minimally invasive way of treating enlarged prostates that cause symptoms for many men. The procedure involves directing microscopic beads through little microcatheters into the arteries that supply blood to the prostate. And by taking away the blood supply, all of the enlarged hyperplastic nodules that crowd out the prostate shrink down and reduce the obstruction and reduce the pressure on the bladder to help reduce symptoms and improve quality of life for men.
So I'm crossing my legs as I ask this question, but how do you get in there? Are you doing this under MRI or what?
No, we did this it's an angiographic procedure. So we do it under X-ray guidance. Most of the procedures these days, or that we do, we enter via the artery in the wrist, the radial artery, but it can be done via the artery in the groin, the femoral artery. And it's very high tech. We have a lot of cutting edge equipment that helps to guide the catheters and wires very accurately into what are very small arteries that supply blood to the prostate. And we can get there with very long catheters. The benefit is that we don't have to cut, we don't have to operate, we don't have to remove any tissue. So that means that the procedure can be done as a day case. It can be done without the need for general anesthesia, and the patient's recovery time is much faster than it would be with many other procedures.
So do you need to catheterize afterwards? Because when you do a TURP, in other words, where you carve out the prostate from the inside,
yep,
you have to put in a catheter because it's got a heel and that's part of the discomfort. Do you need a catheter after this?
No, we don't use a catheter routinely. Fewer than 1% of men will need a catheter. We see the improvements manifest within a couple of weeks of the procedure happening. It does take about a week to get over this particular procedure.
So just describe get over. I mean, does that mean there's a lot of pain or what?
Yeah, there can be some pain. It's usually not too severe. But the things that do, I guess, upset men in those first few days are a worsening of their urinary frequency and urgency. It's quite an irritative type procedure. But those post-inflammatory, post-embolization syndrome symptoms generally resolve after about, or start to improve after about 3 or 4 days and resolve completely by about day 7 or day 8. And we've done quite a few studies now that reliably and consistently show that the improvement takes about a week.
What are the risks?
There are actually very few risks to prostate artery embolization, and that's one of its great advantages over many of the other options that men have. In terms of long-term, durable, irreversible risks, there's really virtually zero, and the rates of those things happening are vanishingly rare. The risks all relate to...
So you're thinking things like incontinence and erectile dysfunction?
Yeah, there's really no association with prostate artery embolization and incontinence or erectile dysfunction. Other impacts on sexual function, things like retrograde ejaculation, dry ejaculations, they don't happen very frequently at all with PAE. In our experience, it's about 3 or 4% of men who get that.
And just to be summarised, when you have one of those more traditional prostate procedures, you do usually have retrograde ejaculation.
Yeah, that's right. It's quite common after surgery, and it's also quite common after long-term treatment with medical therapy.
So there's a whole list. You know, there's a conga line now of technologies for prostate reduction. There's the traditional one, carving it out, effectively using a knife, I'm simplifying it. There's laser, and a lot of people promote laser. I think in the UK now it's largely laser, and they say it's much better than the knife and more durable. There's steam, there's heat. How does this compare to the other interventions that are out there on the market?
This compares very well. We've discussed many of the benefits to the patient in the short term, but long term, it does provide a durable response in most cases for many years, on average about 4 or 5 years. We do know that...
Well, laser's better than that, isn't it?
Laser and some of the surgical options are better than that, but I guess the real benefit to PAE is not having those side effects, not having that impact on sexual function, not having the potential impact on incontinence.
And can you redo?
You can, and you can repeat it. That's right. The other thing that really is in its favour is it doesn't preclude any other future treatment options. So, you know, just like medical therapy as a first-line treatment, if prostate artery embolization is used early on in the disease course, you know, if you do it once or even twice, you can get potentially up to 10 years worth of benefit from this procedure before men then have to consider the more invasive options like surgery.
I mean, this was a head-to-head study with medication for benign prostatic hyperactivity. Medication is pretty useless. So you had an easy goal there.
Well, I guess that may be the case, Norman, but we had to prove it, didn't we? You know, we needed the study, we needed the data to show that. One of the really key things that we wanted to look at was start changing the narrative away from, you know, the rather natural comparisons between PAE and surgeries, and that's understandable. But we really do think that PAE has a role to play in the earlier stages of the disease. And at the moment, the current first-line treatment around the world is medical therapy. So we needed to do a study. We needed to do a high-quality randomized controlled trial that actually looked at PAE versus the standard of care, medical therapy. And that really did demonstrate to us what we suspected all along, and that is that PAE does work better with fewer side effects, fewer complications, and potentially is a lot more durable than medical therapy, which I think really does help to change the options for men in that sort of earlier stage of the disease and helps to validate the role that PAE plays and where it sits on that treatment algorithm for managing large prostates.
So here's an interventional radiologist, you know, eating the urological surgeon's lunch. What's the cost?
Well, we don't look at it that way at all, Norman. We very much,
I'm sure you don't.
We very much, you know, believe in a collaborative approach. You know, we couldn't do what we do in our program if the interventional radiologists and the urologists didn't work together. And I think we have proven in a very successful model that works to improve the outcomes for patients when urologists and interventional radiologists work together.
Two final questions. What does it cost?
Well, the costs vary, I guess, in private, as they all do, but there is Medicare funding for this, and there is funding with private health. So most of the out-of-pockets are quite low. Certainly, it's cheaper and less expensive than surgery, and it's not commonly available in the public system yet, but I guess that's something that we were hoping to change by doing the suite of research that we've done. You know, we're hoping to contribute to that evidence base and see the access to this procedure increase in public and private hospitals around the country. And really, I think Australia's should be following in the footsteps of other jurisdictions around the world where PAE is included in treatment guidelines in the US and then through Europe and the UK. We really would like to see a time when, you know, that can be the case in Australia.
And the final question is, which is the consumer question, is how many of these have you got to do as an interventional radiologist before you're good at it?
Look, there definitely is a learning curve. This isn't what we'd call a basic interventional radiology procedure. This is certainly at the advanced level, probably needing to do upwards of about 100 plus before you sort of consider yourself to be an expert. Our group's done somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 to date.
Dr. Nick Brown, who's Clinical Director of Radiology at the Wesley Hospital in Brisbane. So something new for you to refer to. So what's in the mailbag?
Christine has written in relation to a story we did a couple of weeks ago about salt intake in children and if it impacts their blood pressure. Christine says, iodine was added to table salt to counter an identifier deficiency. Is it still necessary to use iodized salt? Parents are being discouraged from adding salt to food for toddlers and children. Is there any cause for concern if children aren't getting iodine? Dr. Google isn't much help answering this question. Thank you for your fabulous program. I get asked this sometimes and I have pondered it myself, but it's in often bread, unless you're buying organic bread which doesn't contain salt. You get it from shellfish and fish and some vegetables. So, you know, most kids I think are still getting enough, and there's salt in lots of things, Norman, that is added without you realising, and it's probably iodised.
There is. There's still parts of Australia where there's probably low iodine and there's minor risks, but your local GP will know that. But as Priya said, if you're having a healthy, well-rounded diet, you're probably getting enough. You don't need salt to get your iodine.
The next letter is from Cara, who writes, Dear Health Report, I really enjoy your show. I love the banter between Norman and Priya and the talk about N equals one studies.
You're mixing your podcast here. What's That Rash is where we talk about N equals one.
I was thinking.
That's why Priya was sounding a bit confused. I mean, that's where we encourage people to write into our sister podcast, What's That Rash, where you've tried something out on yourself, not a randomised trial, and you've tried it out on yourself, and we're interested in hearing that. Anyway, that's the background to that. Carry on, Priya.
But we also do like the positive feedback about the banter, because we get mixed feedback on that, but we think it's great. So if you like it, definitely write in. But Cara writes, by the way, your show is broadcast on CBC Radio, but I don't get up at 4 a.m. to listen to it. Canada's a big country with many time zones, so I can just choose to listen to it in Flesherton, Ontario at 7 a.m. when it's being broadcast in Vancouver at 4 a.m. Thank you very much.
And a big thanks, Cara, and a big shout out to all our Canadian listeners.
Yes.
A friend of mine in Ontario gets up early just to listen to it. Thank you for your feedback.
There's a Canadian astronaut in space at the moment. They've taken maple syrup up there.
Have they?
Yeah. We do love hearing from you, whether it's feedback, comments, or suggestions for stories. Our address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast. Don't make it N of one. You can make it N of infinity on What's That Rash.
I'll see you after Easter.
Yeah, have fun.
Yeah, you too.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.